Monitor now invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, winner of every major award in its field. Today's guest on Meet the Press will be General Maxwell D. Taylor, who returned this week from his one-year mission as U.S. Ambassador to Vietnam. We'll bring you today's program in a moment.
This is Frank Blair, your Sunday Night Monitor host. A recent visitor to our Sunday Night Monitor show was the elder statesman of American playwrights, Tennessee Williams.
My attitude toward the stage is, you might say my object of love is the stage, and writing plays is my way of life, and I couldn't exist without the stage or without writing for it.
Join us each Sunday night on Monitor. We'll be looking for you on NBC Radio.
Now here is a message from the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. 50 years ago, in 1915, the population of the United States was 100 million, and people in those days used an average of 100 gallons of water a day. Now it's the summer of 1965. We have a population of 200 million, and we use an average of 150 gallons a day for our own needs, for industry, and other purposes. Does this mean that we are going to run short of water? Not necessarily. Not if we keep our rivers, lakes, and groundwater clean. This is why water pollution control is one of our biggest problems, why you and I and everyone else should work to protect our water resources. Today, every one of our 50 states and most of our communities have clean water programs. They need your help. To find out what you can do, get in touch with your state water pollution control agency or write Clean Water, Washington, D.C. And now, Meet the Press. Today's guest, General Maxwell D. Taylor. Our panel consists of Stuart Hensley of United Press International, Jack Raymond of the New York Times, Sander Van Oker, NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak, producer of Meet the Press. Ned Brooks is our moderator.
Our guest today on Meet the Press is General Maxwell D. Taylor, who returned this week from South Vietnam, where he served for the past year as United States Ambassador. During 43 years of public service, General Taylor has been Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Commander-in-Chief of the UN Forces in Korea, and Military Representative of the President for John F. Kennedy. And now we'll have the first question from Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
General Taylor, this week in private, you gave the President and his senior advisors your conclusions on the serious and the optimistic aspects of the situation in Vietnam. What do you consider the most serious aspect of the situation?
It would be hard to isolate a single problem as being the most serious. I would prefer to pair two very important problems. First one in the military field, namely the lack of sufficient trained military manpower to cope with the constant growing strength of the Viet Cong guerrillas. This, of course, results from the continued and increased infiltration of military strength from North Vietnam. The second problem, which I pair with that, is political, that of stability in government in Saigon. You all know the problems that we've had in the last year. I think we've made progress in this field, but the problem certainly still remains.
And what do you consider the one or two most optimistic aspects of the situation there, if any?
By far the most optimistic element in the situation is the new broadened and deepened United States commitment to this country, indicated by the President's announcement of his intention to send additional forces to South Vietnam. This gave an enormous lift to all of us, Americans, Vietnamese, all friends of South Vietnam, when this announcement was made.
General, you have a reputation of being something of an expert on guerrilla warfare. Do you agree with those who insist that to fight a guerrilla you must have a ratio of 10 to 1?
Well, first, I would throw down the suggestion that I'm an expert. There are no experts, truly, in this field. Secondly, I would say no, I do not believe there's any fixed ratio which is necessary for success. It is true that if one analyzes the experiences of past history, there has always been a very large preponderance of force on the side of the government, which is one. However, we have resources and capabilities in South Vietnam no counter-guerrilla force or government ever had in the past. I refer to our air mobility, our helicopters, our fixed-wing aircraft, and all the devices and techniques we have brought to that country.
Well, now, General, we will have about 125,000 American troops there. by the end of this year. There, as some estimates say that we may need 300 to 400,000. Do those estimates meet with your understanding also?
No, I would certainly not suggest the need for anything like 300 to 400,000. Bear in mind that we are really filling a gap in indigenous Vietnamese forces by putting in our own combat ground troops. I'm quite confident in the course of the next year, 1966, the Vietnamese can raise considerably more forces than in the past, although in this last year they raised some 140,000 additional troops and police. No, I would not agree that any figure like 300 to 400,000 is likely to be required.
Would you give us any estimate of what you consider the requirements to be?
It would be very risky. I would say we should do as we have in the past, namely cut and try. I think the 125,000 figure announced by the president is a very reasonable increment to bring in at this time. I would expect additional forces, but I would not be willing to try to predict the total figure.
General, one more question. The American people are being told we're in for a very long war. Do you think that, too, from your experience of a year?
It'll be a long pull, yes, sir.
Now, when you speak of a long war, do you mean 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Again, you ask me to be a prophet, and I'm very reluctant to say. Certainly, I would not expect anything less than 1 to 2 years.
We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Raymond.
General Taylor, you just hesitated to be a prophet about the duration of the war, and yet it wasn't so long ago, I think it was in 1962, that you and Secretary McNamara predicted that we could pull the bulk of our forces out of Vietnam by Christmas of that year. Now, can you tell us what happened and why did we allow it to happen?
Well, that experience, of course, is the reason I'm so cautious today. The serious answer to your question is that at that time we had not had the political turbulence in Saigon. We had the relatively stable government of President Diem. It had been in office for almost 8 years. We did not anticipate the internal political problem which arose after the fall of his government. I think that is the primary factor which changed the situation and which certainly changed my estimate of how long this will last.
Well, General Taylor, do you believe that if the Diem government had not fallen, if he had not been assassinated, and if all of those events hadn't taken place the way they did, that we would not be faced with this crisis and we would have been able to control that insurgency?
No, I'm not willing to say that. I think only history will tell in retrospect after we can stand back from this situation over a number of years. There were many weaknesses and defects in the Diem government and which occasioned its fall. How far we could have gone with the Diem government, frankly, I don't know.
General Taylor, is this still an insurgency? Are we still fighting a counterinsurgency? Or is this not the familiar land war that we fought in the past, where we tried to take territory and destroy the opposition in our way?
Of course, there are many factors which are similar to what you might call conventional warfare. We're trying to destroy an enemy, namely the Viet Cong. However, there are also many differences. This is not the war clearly delimited fronts, of compartments of terrain. Our objectives are not the kind which we normally had in our problems in Leavenworth in World Wars I and II. There are very, really fundamental differences, I would say.
Mr. Hensley.
General Taylor, this question of a land war in Asia has always concerned the American people. Now, the State Department, just a year ago, right after the Tonkin Gulf incident, issued a document entitled Vietnam, the Struggle for Freedom, in which it said that U.S. combat units in that war in Vietnam would face several obvious disadvantages because the knowledge of terrain, language, and local customs was especially important. The State Department paper then went on and said, in addition, the introduction of U.S. combat units would provide ammunition for communist propaganda, which falsely proclaims that the United States is conducting a white man's war against Asians. The question is, does this escalation which the president has undertaken recently put us in a position which is contrary to what the State Department was advocating at that time, and if so, why?
No, I think the observations of the State Department at that time were quite correct. There are serious objections to the introduction of land forces in South Vietnam. However, the requirement has become so great, so obvious, that these requirements overcame the arguments which you've just mentioned. We must fill in the manpower gap which exists in South Vietnam to the degree that we can blunt and defeat the monsoon offensive and remove from the minds of the leaders of Hanoi any hope that they may have of a successful military outcome in South Vietnam.
Well, you speak of increasing the military manpower of the South Vietnamese government. Now, when you were here for consultation several months ago, prior to your return this time, there was talk then about one of the objectives being to help the South Vietnamese increase their armed forces by 160,000 men. Has anything been accomplished on that?
Yes, I believe I mentioned the increase of 120,000 in the armed forces and over 20,000 in the police. So we have roughly 140,000 already, and still several months of the calendar year to run. This program is going quite well. On the other hand, the program of the Viet Cong for expansion has gone even better.
Well, that brings me to a question I'd like to ask you, since you have the experience there. Secretary McNamara, in testifying before the House Appropriations Committee a few days ago, estimated the hard core Viet Cong strength at 70,000. The State Department in February, in its white paper, estimated the hardcore Viet Cong strength at 35,000. Our air attacks on North Vietnam were undertaken with one objective, to halt infiltration and try to reduce this number. Despite 6 months of air attacks, according to the government's own figures, the Viet Cong hardcore strength has doubled. How do you explain this, General Taylor?
Well, I'd make two comments. First, one doesn't know at what time a given a soldier from North Vietnam came into South Vietnam. In other words, we're finding today and adding to our list men who have been in the came to the country over a year ago, before the air attacks started. Secondly, no one ever suggested the air attacks are going to stop completely infiltration. It obviously will not. But anyone also who looks at the destruction which has been affected on the communications, the roads, the bridges, the railroads in North Vietnam, must believe that these attacks have had a very clear depressive effect upon infiltration.
Mr. Van Oker.
General, you've been intimately associated with this Vietnam problem for 5 years on the military side and on the diplomatic side. Can you please tell me what precisely is our national interest in Vietnam?
Well, I would say we have at least three very good reasons for being in South Vietnam and doing what we're doing. First, we're fulfilling the pledge to help a small country under attack, which has been made by three successive presidents. Secondly, we realize the effect in South Vietnam, in Southeast Asia, and elsewhere in the world, if indeed South Vietnam became absorbed into the communist state. And finally, we recognize that we're faced with the announced purpose of the communists to use guerrilla warfare. They call it the War of Liberation, as the favored tactic for the future expansion of communism. If it succeeds in South Vietnam, we're going to face it all around the world, so we better defeat it here.
Well, General, if I may say so with respect, the three things you have given me fall into the category of abstractions. Now, they don't fit the time-honored classical definitions of national interest, like the British for 400 years. They couldn't allow a continental power to dominate the continent. Today, the Soviet Union cannot have a reunited Germany allied with the West. But what is our specific strategic interest in holding Vietnam?
I don't agree that my statements were abstractions. I think they're very specific, that we have specific promises and pledges which we must fulfill by specific actions. We have a specific country, South Vietnam, which may go down and carry with it specific countries like Thailand, like Laos, and also countries which are nearby, the Philippines, for example. And we have a very specifically announced threat, the use of wars of liberation to extend communism. I can't imagine anything more specific than that program.
Well, sir, I believe that as a young officer, you served in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I have always been led to believe that the American Army has always dreaded, is not too strong a word perhaps, getting involved in precisely the kind of war we are involved in South Vietnam, with no end in sight, really. Now, what has changed in the world that has caused the American Army to make this kind of commitment, or have it made for it by the Commander-in-Chief, to get involved in this kind of an Asia? And doesn't this jeopardize our position elsewhere in the world?
Well, I'm glad you made the point that the Army is not making the decisions where it goes. It's being sent where it, to these various parts of the world. And no soldier enjoys warfare in itself. He discharges his duty as directed by the commander-in-chief. Ideally, the continent of Asia is not the place to put large land forces, nor do we plan to put large land forces there. We intend to keep this, the War of South Vietnam, where we are doing only those things which the Vietnamese cannot do for themselves. So I would say, I have been one of those, I might say, who have been very reluctant to recommend the introduction of ground forces in South Vietnam, but now I see the indispensability of their presence if we're going to accomplish those three objectives which I mentioned.
Sir, if I can just follow that up and make sure I understand you right, you say there is some kind of a finite limit on how many troops we will commit in South Vietnam.
No,
not asking you to be specific.
No, there is definitely not a finite number. The president said he will do as much and as long as is necessary, and I believe that's the only formula that one can announce.
Mr. Spivak.
General Taylor, the New York Times last November quoted you as saying, and I quote, "I have enlisted in this war for the duration." Now, your health seems pretty good. Just why did you resign, General?
Because of an agreement which I'd had with the president, in view of my long government service and my extended periods of time overseas, I felt that the year, or approximately a year, would be a reasonable commitment to make. As the time approached, I must admit, it became strangely hard to leave South Vietnam. One becomes tremendously immersed with the problems there. But I can't look to the future and see any finite point to which one might aspire to carry on, feeling that, that thereafter there'd be no unfinished business.
Well, General, in November, when you said you had enlisted for the duration in answer to a question, you had made that one-year deal. Why did you enlist in November for the duration, but now in August feel that the year must control your resignation?
Really, for
date?
The same the purposes I indicated, namely that the duration seems to be virtually infinite.
General, there have been, as you must know, reports in this country that you favored stronger U.S. action as early as January of last year in order to avoid defeat, but you were overruled by the State Department and the President. Is there any truth in those reports?
No, I would say not. I have made various recommendations. Some have not been followed completely. That's entirely normal. I've been making recommendations for years and expect that they will never be met in their entirety. By and large, I would say our strategy today is that which I've been recommending.
Well, there are also reports that civilians are in complete control of the war we're fighting in Vietnam, that they dictate strategy and supervise tactics and operations. Was there any truth in that? Did that disturb you and lead to your resignation?
Of course, there should be truth in the statement that the say civilian, namely the commander-in-chief, the president, controls and directs all operations. I believe in civilian control of that type. The implication, however, that the civilians are getting deeply into professional and technical matters in South Vietnam is not true. General Westmoreland has virtual complete freedom of action in the use of his forces.
Would you say, then, that for the most part you approve of the way the war is being conducted in Vietnam today?
That is correct.
Mr. Raymond.
General Taylor, you're stressing how vital to American national security the war in South Vietnam was. Is there any place in the world that is not vital to American national security?
Yes, I can think of a number of places.
Well, sir, suppose Soviets or the Chinese or any communist leader undertook to fight a war of national liberation on another continent. And we started out by giving aid to our friends, as we always do, and give military assistance to our friends, as we always do, and suddenly found ourselves confronted with another war of national liberation. Do we have to commit ourselves there as we have committed ourselves in South Vietnam?
I wouldn't be willing to make a statement on a hypothetical situation. I would say each one would have to be looked at very closely.
Well, sir,
then the
specific situation is this. Is the United States to be the policeman against communism throughout the world?
No, I would say not. Not as I view the proper course of action. However, we're vitally interested in any expansion of communism anywhere, and certainly we would look at that situation very closely.
Why don't we bomb Hanoi, General Taylor?
We don't need to.
We can win without bombing Hanoi?
As a matter of fact, we don't. I wouldn't think we would want to bomb Hanoi. I think we need the leadership in Hanoi to be intact, to make those essential decisions we hope they will make at some time.
Then our aim is to fight this war without bombing Hanoi.
I would not make that statement.
Well, isn't that the implication of what you're saying?
No. Thus far, it has not been necessary.
General Taylor.
Mr. Hensley.
I just follow that up a little bit farther. There have been some officials who have said, at least privately, that bombing Hanoi and bombing too much of the what industrial complex they have around Hanoi, Haiphong area, and so forth, would do so much damage that there wouldn't be much use in Ho Chi Minh keeping his army around to guard that, and he might send it into South Vietnam. Does that play any element in your thinking?
I wouldn't think of it in those terms. I think we have to bear in mind what our program, our bombing program in North Vietnam, was designed to do and what it was not designed to do. It had three purposes. The first was to give the South Vietnamese some way to strike back against the source of the devastations committed by the communists. The second was to limit, insofar as possible, infiltration from North Vietnam into South Vietnam. And third, it was to remind the leaders in Hanoi that they must pay an increasingly high price for a continuation of their help to the Viet Cong. Those were the three purposes, and I think it's been doing, those three are being accomplished reasonably well.
May I ask you something more specific within South Vietnam? Marshal Key, the premier at the present time, had a news conference yesterday. In the course of this, he said, according to news reports, that desertions from the South Vietnamese army had been running 4,000 to 5,000 men a month until last month, July, when they were only somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500. He didn't explain in any of the accounts I saw either why they had been running at the previous rate or why they dropped. Do you have any information on this?
I can't confirm the figures because I don't have them here, but it's true that desertion has been a major problem throughout this calendar year, resulting from a number of factors: heavy losses in battle, the understrength of units engaged in action, the failure of the government to anticipate those things in personnel management, which we would think are quite normal, aid to dependents, to aid to the wounded, and that sort of thing. Recognizing, however, at last, the importance of this problem, the government now has a program including about 11 courses of action to work on the causes of desertion. And I'm pleased to hear General Key say that the drop-off has been as dramatic as you suggest.
Mr. Van Oken.
General, in terms of our specific military strategy in Vietnam now, how do you fight an enemy that refuses to engage you on your terms? I take the experience of the 173rd, where they went for 5 days and killed one VC, the experience of the Marines around Da Nang, where they have never been attacked in any formation larger than a squad. How do you defeat, if that word has any meaning in Vietnam, an enemy that won't fight you on your terms?
This has always been one of the great problems, as you know, Mr. Van Oker. It's the fact that the guerrilla, by the nature of the warfare, has the initiative. It's more or less like the bandits have the initiative on the police. They can decide the time and place when they will commit their depredation. However, it's not an impossible problem, because the Viet Cong must form up to strike objectives which they must take. We on our side have speeded our rate of reaction to the point that now, instead of taking a couple of days to get out to a town that is beleaguered by the Viet Cong, we can get out in the course of that very night, so that reaction is becoming much faster and more effective. Furthermore, as we get greater forces, we can always move towards some objective which is so valuable to the Viet Cong, they must stand and fight.
But sir, supposing the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, the communists, who've been fighting this now for 20 years, decide that they have brought in too many American troops into that country, they're going to tell their cadres to bury their arms, keep things intact, get jobs working for the Americans, and we'll see how long the Americans will sit this out. What do we do?
Well, I think if they put down their arms, our friends in South Vietnam will very speedily occupy the country and assume complete control of it.
And then we withdraw?
Whenever the situation is such that South Vietnam is no longer threatened by communist aggression.
We have, gentlemen, about 1 minute. Mr.
General,
Spivak.
I believe you and other military men have been saying for some years now that it would be unthinkable for the United States once again to get involved in a ground war. Isn't that what we're involved in now, though?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. This is still the Vietnamese war. Bear in mind, they have almost 600,000 armed men now in South Vietnam. Our contribution is necessarily a minority contribution in terms of effort involved.
Well, aren't these 125,000 men of ours going to be fighting a ground war?
No, not all of them. As a matter of fact, up to now, most of the forces we have committed have not been ground forces, and in the future, logistic forces, advisors, air forces, all will play a very important part.
Mr. Hensley, a short question.
General Taylor, is the United States military commitment going to become so great there and our involvement in the political situation so much that eventually we're going to have to take over and run the country?
I wouldn't think so. I don't think we could. I don't think we would. I don't think we should.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Ambassador Taylor, for being with us today on Meet the Press.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. In just a moment, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of this week's Meet the Press interview.
This is Frank Blair, your Sunday Night Monitor host. Miss Olivia de Havilland had high praise indeed for one of her fellow stars on a recent Monitor broadcast when asked who her favorite actor was.
It's hard to say. I think Henry Fonda impressed me very, very deeply when we worked together. He was really extremely kind to me and helpful. And then his own work was so impressive. And you see, he was acting in the theater. And theoretically, there is a different style or technique for the theater. But he explained to me that he had no difference. He said, for him, the only change was the question of projecting the voice, that otherwise the performance was as controlled for the theater as it was for cinema.
With people like Mr. Havilland, to brighten your Sunday Night Monitor scene, you can be sure of an evening of fine entertainment. Join us this Sunday on NBC Radio.
At one time, the Peace Corps was only an idea. 4 years ago, it became a reality. Today, it is a force at work in the world serving 46 developing nations. Peace Corps volunteers have become a critical resource in many nations' plans for a better life. Architects in Tunisia, foresters in Nepal, mechanics and nurses in Afghanistan, and English teachers in Turkey are making their presence felt. If you would like to help, take the Peace Corps placement test at 9 a.m. Saturday, August 14th at your main post office. Now, more details on Meet the Press. Today's guest was General Maxwell D. Taylor. The panel consisted of Jack Raymond of the New York Times, Sander Van Oker, NBC News, Lawrence E. Spivak, producer of Meet the Press, and Stuart Hensley of United Press International. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, and send 10 cents in coin and a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C. That's Merkle Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Box 2111, Washington, D.C. When your children are ready for college, will you be ready for the bills? Well, the time to start saving is now. A good way to start saving is with United States Series E savings bonds purchased on the payroll savings plan where you work or at your bank. Bonds are safe and sure, protected against loss. They make your education fund grow while your child grows. Remember, these saving bonds will pay $4 for every $3 invested while they mature. And each bond is guaranteed by your government. You'll be pleasantly surprised to find how easy the payroll savings plan is. Your employer saves a few dollars for you before you get your pay. You won't even miss the money. So, start today. Ensure your child's education. By U.S. Savings Bonds, the star-spangled savings plan for all Americans. Meet the Press will not be heard August 15th and August 22nd, but will return on August 29th, when our guest will again be another prominent figure in the news.
This is Russ Ward. The 8-day flight of Gemini 5 is scheduled for Thursday, August 19th. Follow it all on NBC Radio and Television.